Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Pepsi Center at the Democratic Convention in Denver. And if the eternal political question is who is more macho, it seems a little more heated than usual this election cycle. Joining me now is Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Susan Faludi. Her most recent book is The Terror Dream, Myth and Misogyny in an Insecure America. And she wrote an op-ed piece in yesterday's New York Times entitled Second Place Citizens, and another one last month, Analyzing Masculinity, McCain and Obama Style. So, Susan Faludi, thanks so much for coming back on WNYC with us. Hello from Denver.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And in your op-ed yesterday, and let's start there, you wrote that in the struggle for women's equality, every victory turns out to be partial or pyrrhic. Put this in historical context for us and tell us how you think it relates to Denver.
Well, over and over again in the course of American women's history, women have worked very hard to make change, only to have the rug yanked out from under them. The most notable example of this, ironically, is suffrage, ironically, because that was the big theme last night since August 26th was the 88th anniversary.
We're going to play a clip of Hillary Clinton from her speech last night on that in a couple of minutes, but go ahead.
And so after, you know, a century of struggle, we get suffrage. And then a year later, it's declared in the media as, you know, women are done with feminism. Actually, the term post-feminism, as Harvard professor Nancy Cott pointed out, was actually coined in the 20s, not in our era. And women began to backslide on many fronts, economically, in their representation in many fields, in politics. Very few women were able to rise to become congresswomen. The one woman who was senator was allowed to be senator for a day to warm the seat of a male senator. And then, you know, we went through this big dark ages that really lasted until the end of the 60s with the second wave of the women's movement. And again, so much hard work went into the second wave of the women's movement, only to, you know, hit the 80s and again be plunged into years and years of
have
backlash.
Have all that backlash, and a lot of people will remember your first book, which was called Backlash. I want to ask, and actually in this conversation I want to talk mostly about the ideas in your August 6th op-ed about McCain and Obama representing competing notions of masculinity in this election. Margaret Cho was on our show yesterday, and she said the contest is between the family man and the soldier. I wonder what you think of that way of putting it and how you would put it in terms of how it's competing notions of masculinity.
Well, I think it goes even deeper than that to the all-American myth of American invincibility that we hold so dear. And you really see in this campaign a sort of referendum on that myth we wrapped ourselves in after 9/11, you know, that cowboy fantasy of America as the fortress guarded by strong frontiersmen and helpless, grateful women, or to put it in 9/11 terms, presidential sheriffs and cowering security moms. Remember security moms,
They were the 2004 supposed swing voters.
Exactly. And in 2004, we saw both the Democratic and the GOP presidential presidential candidates competing for that role of presidential sheriff, you know, playing Davy Crockett in chief, bragging about their gun collections, you know, carry out their shooting animals every other weekend. And both of them, you know, playing the we're going to protect our women and children from terrorists who were supposedly about to invade the suburbs. But this time around, the Democrats have really challenged that myth. I mean, starting with Hillary Clinton saying, you know, elect me and I'll put an end to cowboy diplomacy. But in particular...
Although, you know, in the In the primaries, we'll get back to that in a second, but since you brought up Hillary's role in that, in the primaries, many people said Clinton actually played the more male gender role and Obama the more female. He was the softer or the explainer and she was the fighter, things like that. I'm sure you heard that. I wonder how you saw that.
Right. Well, she, you know, the other key part of the myth we live by is that in order for men to be strong, women have to be weak. And Hillary Clinton, first of all, had to, because she was a woman, present herself as a very tough commander-in-chief. But simply by doing that, she challenged the traditional gender roles that are so embedded in American life. Obama, in a sense, pushed that even further by refusing to play that sort of faux tough guy game of posing in military camo and shooting away from a duck blind.
He's never shot a friend of his in the face, as far as we know.
That's one of the advantages of never picking up a gun. But what we have this time, so on the Democratic side, we have a candidate who is resisting that, John Wayne role. On the other side, we have McCain, whose campaign is billing his story as a sort of Daniel Boone tale, this captive who withstood torture, shades of 9/11, suffering from a non-white terrorist captors in Vietnam and how he prevailed in the end. And that's going to be his big theme.
His story is presumably true, right? It happened to him.
No, of course, but it's not that it was made up. It's just that that's the major thread of argument.
Of what he's about.
Yeah. Right, that we should vote for him because he was
forged in
this
experience. And we even saw it in his response. Right, we even saw it in his response to the houses. Right, he owns 7 homes or whatever the number is and doesn't know how many, and then his campaign put out a press release that said, among other things, yes, John McCain has lived in a variety of places. He was a guest of the enemy in Hanoi for 7 years. Mm-hmm. I do want to open up our phones for Susan Faludi on the notions of masculinity in this presidential campaign. Do you see it the way she does, that there are, in fact, competing notions of masculinity with Obama and McCain being the candidates this year, and that matters? Give us a call. Men, give us a call. Women, give us a call. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. While your calls are coming in, I want to play another clip of Hillary Clinton from her speech last night, and this is where she does pay some tribute to that anniversary of women's suffrage on August 26th, 1920.
I'm a United States Senator because in 1848, a group of courageous women and a few brave men gathered in Seneca Falls, New York, many traveling for days and nights to participate in the first convention on women's rights in our history. And so dawned a struggle for the right to vote that would last 72 years, handed down by mother to daughter to granddaughter and a few sons and grandsons along the way. These women and men looked into their daughters' eyes and imagined a fairer and freer world and found the strength to fight, to rally, to picket, to endure ridicule and harassment and brave violence and jail. And after so many decades, 88 years ago on this very day, the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote, became enshrined in our Constitution.
Susan Faludi, my guest on WNYC, talking about the op-eds that she's had in the last month about women and men and the presidential campaign. And Scott in Larchmont, you're on WNYC. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Brian. Thank you very much. I read Ms. Faludi's op-ed piece yesterday, and I agreed with much of it, but I feel that all the lamentations lately about Hillary's loss really demonstrates a lack of maturity in the women's movement, because I would have voted for Hillary, but she voted for the Iraq War and still refuses to apologize for it. She voted for the Patriot Act. She voted for the Burn the Flag Amendment. I just couldn't vote for her.
Susan,
that's
Ford,
all I had to say.
Thank you very much. Talk about role reversal. You know, there are people saying, including this guy, that Hillary Clinton was the one who, maybe because she felt she had to compensate for being a woman and how women are perceived with respect to being a potential commander-in-chief, you know, maybe it was calculated. Maybe she felt she had to overcompensate, and yet she came down on the wrong side of that issue for so many Democratic primary voters.
Right, and, you know, and this is not to say that, I certainly don't believe that one should vote simply on the basis of identity politics. What I was exploring in that op-ed piece is why there is this deep underlying anger from Hillary's supporters. So, I mean, an anger that verges on such bitterness that there are women saying, well, we're just going to, you know, take our ball and go home or vote for McCain. And so what I was exploring was where that anger comes from. And I think it comes from, you know, time and again, women being told it's not, you know, it's not your turn. It's not your hour. You know, it's the Wizard of Oz line, go away and come back tomorrow. And the women who are Hillary Clinton's supporters, particularly older women, so many of them have, you know, fought their whole lives, one, you know, either personally or politically, to have that advance their circumstances so that they had, you know, some authority, some agency, some way of determining their lives.
Let's take another call. I want to go to another call. Steve in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Brian. You're doing a great job out there. I hope the weather's
Thanks
good.
Thanks a lot. Weather's great.
My feeling is that I think the anger lies in the fact that women try to play the rules as they think that it's been handed down from up on high from the male gender. And when they do play by the rules, as Hillary does, she gets whacked for it. I mean, the problem is that we make...
Wait, I want to get back to Miss... I don't want to make this actually another... The point of this conversation was really not to have another Hillary discussion, but to talk about competing notions of masculinity, which I think you said to my screener that leadership and masculinity are one and the same. Did
no,
you say
what
that?
What I said was that that's how we have seen it, but it's time we don't see it that way. All you have to do is look around at other great world leaders like Indira Gandhi, Margaret Thatcher, Golda Meir. I mean, these are women that have led countries. There's no reason why that shouldn't be the case here. I think
right,
that
Steve, I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to go on to Peter in Manhattan next. Peter, you're on WNYC with
Brian,
Susan Faludi.
I don't think it's a macho matchup as suggested by Ms. Faludi. Really, what comes to light when you talk about the military background, Obama never handled a gun, you're talking about the track of experience once again. McCain has got a long line of experience to make a judgment by. On Mr. Obama's part, I'd suggest it's rather thin, so it's not this macho match.
Peter, thank you very much. Susan Faludi, I'm curious, what did you think of Michelle Obama's speech on Monday night?
Oh, I thought it was beautifully executed. It pained me some that she had, and I understand completely why she had to do it, but that it was, you know, I'm a mom, I'm a sister, I'm a daughter, I'm a wife. I was, not once was... did she even mention that she is also somebody with a professional, important career? And
so she was so trying so hard to be the average mom that it made you cringe?
Well, particularly at the end with the, you know, bringing out of the children. And I wish we would arrive at a point where women didn't have to do that. I completely understood why she did it. I think I preferred the Hillary Clinton's I'm a proud mother line, go, and then immediately, and I'm a proud Democrat, and you know, immediately going to the public and the political, since this is a political event we're involved in. But Michelle Obama is the first lady, so you know it's very complicated. But what you know, what really struck me was how, I mean, clearly her mission was to soften her image, as the media pundits kept saying. And what's tragic is that she had to do that, you know, because she had been cast as a, quote, you know, angry woman, and in her case, and quote, angry black woman, you know, a classic case of how race and gender discrimination amplify each other. When,
Richard,
you know,
she
should be
Island.
Angry. We all should be
angry. And you know what? We had some of our callers yesterday were saying they were disappointed in Michelle Obama because they wanted her to show more attitude, though getting that this was a soften your image, do damage control kind of moment. Still, some of our listeners were disappointed that she didn't just kind of come out as more of who she really is, or they think she really is. Richard on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I think the guest misunderstands the reason why McCain's prison background is so powerful for him. It's because he has convinced most Americans that he would never put his own self-interest or aggrandizement over what's right and what's for the country, compared to Obama associating with Wright and Refco and voting present so often in the Illinois legislature and voting straight down the Democrat Party line. That's why McCain's background is so powerful.
Thank you very much. So we've had two callers who said it's just not about notions of masculinity. It's really about other things. And it's not that, Susan, you expect people to go into the voting booth and say, I'm voting for Barack Obama because he's the softer male role model, is it?
No. And, you know, people do gender roles are always beneath the surface. It's not like anyone is consciously thinking about this. And it's not just about masculinity, it's about masculinity as defined by this mythology that the country forged over many years in response to our frontier background. I mean, McCain's experience as a captive is very powerful because it brings back that foundational history where for the first two centuries of early American life, the you know central experience was repeated raids on frontier settlements and repeated failures to protect families in frontier towns. And out of that,
which
we
is
created
really
this
central,
whole mythology.
The central theme of your book, The Terror Dream: Myth and Misogyny in the United States, is that we're still enthralled to this bloody early history, when Indians were raiding white settlements and the various wars, and that still has a subconscious pull on our politics. That's your larger point, isn't it?
Exactly. And if you go back and look at the real history, it wasn't all, you know, John Wayne's guarding Little Debbie's. Over and over again, there was a failure to rescue people who have been taken captive. And according to one study, more than a quarter of all women who were taken captive were never rescued, and 60% of girls were never rescued. And one-third of women who were abducted ultimately chose to stay with their captors because they preferred Indian life. So this is our real history, and we slathered on that over, you know, we created over 150 years this mythology of ourselves as this unassailable nation, protected by a million, Last of the Mohicans, Hawkeyes, and John Wayne's.
One last comment from a McCain supporter who posted on our comments page, who wrote, answer to the question, what kind of man, the kind of man who chose to remain in hell rather than leave his brothers in arms behind versus a cover guy for GQ. So people have a lot to say, one side or the other, about this question of notions of masculinity, as subtext, at least, in this presidential race. And Susan Faludi, her two op-ed pieces in the New York Times yesterday and on August 6th, and her book, The Terror Dream. Thanks a lot for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
And now we'll bring you some more sounds of Denver and the convention. One of the main strips in Denver is 16th Street, which is sort of a pedestrian mall with a free shuttle bus running the length of it. And with so many visitors in town for the convention, that bus has to wade its way through the mass of people that usually means honking the horn a whole bunch. Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Democratic Convention. Don't forget you can follow us on Twitter during these two convention weeks. If you're a Twitter user, just sign up to follow Brian Lehrer, one word, or watch for my updates through the day. If you're not a Twitter user, on the WNYC homepage, they'll keep showing up. Malcolm Smith is with us now, state senator from the Jamaica, Queens area of New York and leader of the Democrats in the New York State Senate. If the Democrats take the Senate in the November elections, he would presumably become majority leader, the job that Joe Bruno held for so long, and Malcolm Smith would become one of the three men in a room with Governor Patterson and Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, all wielding so much power over policy and decisions in New York State. Senator Smith, nice to have you back on WNYC. Hi there.
Brian, good to be on WNYC, coming from Denver, Colorado, where the Democratic Convention is in full swing.
Right. So in a minute, I'll ask you what's happening at the convention that's relevant to New York. But what do you think it would change in terms of policy if the Democrats do control all three wings of government in New York State after the November election?
Well, I think primarily the number one thing that happens is we change the rules by which the New York State Senate is governed by. And what that means is there will be a lot more transparency. There will be a lot more involvement from the different advocacy groups. But you also would have resources being distributed fairly to the members. And you also would have bills coming to the floor, not just being held up by just a leader. I really believe that if we have a democratic process, and I don't care if it's Republicans or Democrats, if they can garner enough support, whether it's in committee or on the floor, to move forward, I think it's worthwhile. We've lost a lot of ground in New York State.
So are you saying that you would distribute some of the power? You would actually give away power? This is so hard for leaders to do. This is why the three men in a room, though everybody decries it, has not actually been, you know, that power hasn't been spread out around more people, because nobody wants to give away the power that they have. You're saying you would give away some of your own power if you're Senate Majority Leader?
I think, Brian, I think it's better. I think part of the reason why we are facing a $6 billion deficit, now $5, because Governor Patterson obviously shepherded us into a good direction in terms of cutting spending, but part of the challenge is we have a lot of intellectual capital in our members, and the fact that we don't allow them to use that and to have their ideas being brought forward has put New York State in a place where it's not leadership that it was before. I think, the more the better. Two heads are always better than one.
Now, you got into some hot water recently for seeming to threaten lobbyists about losing their clout if they don't start funding Democrats in these Senate races. Is that how you make government policy?
No, absolutely not. That was a joke. Everybody knew it. I found out that day. I'm not a comedian. I'm going to leave that up to everybody else. I like to quote Mayor Theo LaGuardia, who always says, when I make a mistake, it's a beaut. And that's all that was. The bottom line is that I'm actually the author of a clean money, clean campaign bill that actually basically restructures campaign finance so that we have stricter limits on the amount of money members we receive from outside individuals. And so, we have always championed that. Actually, if it was not for the Republicans holding that up this year, that may have happened.
And Shelley Silver, the Assembly Leader, was on here at the convention and said all Democratic rule would mean government would stop being over-concerned about the tax rates on million-dollar earners. Are you ready to sign on to that tax hike on the million-plus?
Well, no, we, you know, I run a Democratic conference, our conference has been deliberating that issue for quite some time now, and we haven't taken a position on that. I myself personally am not a person that believes in taxing individuals. I think, as was been saying around the convention down here, you know, the promise of this country, like the promise of New York, is that if you work hard and play by the rules, you can do well. And I don't think we should penalize people for working hard and doing well by taking things from them. I believe everybody does have to commit their share to make sure that the municipal services and the statewide services that we offer to make our state and city better should be contributed. But I don't think it should be overburdened to the individuals who work very hard.
Give me just a minute before you go on what you think the election of Barack Obama would mean for your district in Southeast Queens. We don't hear a lot from the Obama campaign, at least in most of the public appearances, about urban policy. What would it mean for Southeast Queens? What would it mean for New York City, in your opinion?
Well, I think what it will mean right off the bat is Barack Obama talks about putting America back to work. And clearly, jobs and our economy moving in the right direction is critical. And more importantly, and more to home, we are now paying, you know, in excess of $3.50 to almost $4 a gallon for gas. I believe we will have he'll have a direct impact on that, because clearly we're going to try to relieve ourselves of our dependency on foreign oil. And you know the impact that has had. We now pay almost $5 for a gallon of milk and almost $3 for a loaf of bread. And to individuals in my district as well as around the city, that becomes a hardship for many people who are making salaries of $30,000 to $50,000 a year in a household. And every dollar counts. We don't want people making a decision whether they're going to buy fuel for their car or fuel for their home or even food. And when they're debating those two issues, it becomes critical. So I think a Barack Obama presidency hits those things directly.
All right. Malcolm Smith, New York State Senator from the Jamaica, Queens area, in line to likely be the state Senate majority leader if the Democrats can just pick up a couple more seats in the November election and become the majority in the state Senate as well as the Assembly. Senator, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Brian. Always good to be on your show.
We are out on Larimer Street in downtown Denver for our Meet the Delegates series. We have a delegate named Gail Horowitz from Ohio. She's a lawyer. Tell us what your hometown is and what's great about your hometown.
Oh, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and as you know, Ohio is a really important swing state this election. We have a lot of enthusiastic people, and we're really excited to make a change.
I hear that Ohio is less likely to go for Obama than it was for Kerry. Why is that?
Oh, I don't think that's true at all. I think people are still just getting to know Senator Obama, and I think that, you know, in the 68 days we have left before the election, we're definitely going to spread the word. He's a great candidate, and he really is the change that this country needs.
Is that a big problem in Cleveland? I keep hearing that phrase, people don't know Obama. They need to be getting to know Obama.
Well, you know, I think people in Cleveland are struggling, a lot of them. There's a lot going on. We're having a terrible foreclosure crisis. People are really working hard to make ends meet, so there's certainly a lot on their minds, unfortunately, besides the presidential election. But I think we'll get the word out, and we'll definitely tell them that Senator Obama can really provide them some help.
Whose delegate are you?
I'm an at-large delegate pledged to Obama, so I guess I'm a statewide at-large delegate.
Are you having a lot of fights and arguments with your Hillary delegate friends?
No, not at all, actually. One of my good friends is what's called the Hillary Whip, so she's working hard to make sure that all of the Hillary folks are on board with us. And actually, all the Hillary folks I've talked to in our delegation are right on board. They're working to spread the word, especially among female friends, that Senator Obama is the one who cares about pay equity and cares about choice, and all the issues that women care about are the ones he cares about, and frankly the ones that Senator McCain does not care about.
What does it mean to you to be a Democrat in 2008?
I think being a Democrat today is all about having hope for the future. It's about not giving up, and it's about believing that even though times are tough, there's a lot that we can do to make tomorrow better than today.
Who's your favorite Democrat ever?
favorite Democrat ever. Well, right now I'm really in love with Nancy Pelosi. I think she's so exciting. I love the fact that she's the first female speaker. It means so much to me when she had her first State of the Union where they introduced Madam Speaker. It brought tears to my eyes. I think she's amazing.
Thanks a lot. Enjoy the convention.
Thank you so much.
And that delegate part of our Meet the Delegates series. We will be back on the streets of Denver doing more of those this afternoon for tomorrow's show. Quick reminder that while the nominating conventions are going on in Denver and St. Paul, our 30 issues in 30 days nominating process is now underway at WNYC.org. And we invite you to nominate an issue for our presidential election series, 30 issues in 30 days. More than 100 people have nominated issues already. We'll vote on your issues next month before the series starts in September. Nominate one now at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Well, we are joined once again by political Svengali and humorist Mo Rocca. Hey, Mo.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay. Did you watch the speeches last night in the hall or on TV?
I watched it in the hall. I couldn't get in. The police had cut off access. So I was with the rabble out here, just right outside the where all the action was happening in the hallway.
And what was that like for you?
It was, look, even out here, the Hillary tribute, my God, I was awash in a sea of estrogen. I mean, all this girl power stuff. It was really, really exciting. I mean, from the video, which I thought was really deftly produced, I really did think it was terrific. The images of Hillary were terrific. And it was funny. It actually had humor in it. And then when Chelsea Clinton sashayed out onto stage. I mean, she's America's next top Clinton. I mean, she's amazing. And I have to say, it's talk about turning lemons into lemonade. She takes a losing candidacy and turns herself into a civil rights hero. And I'm not saying that derisively, but I mean, it was pretty canny.
What do you think of some of the reaction shots? Did you see them?
Bill Clinton, Michelle
Obama, Joe Biden.
One of these days, Bill Clinton's going to bite his lip too hard and it's just going to bleed. But I thought the mouthing of I love you was kind of neat. I like that. Michelle Obama looked...
By the third or fourth time, maybe it was a little...
I thought he was kind of drunk at that point. It got a little Joe Namath-y. But then I thought that the Michelle Obama, she looked really stressed. I thought written all over her face was like, give me the keys to the White House, lady. Just give them up. And you could just feel, Hillary Clinton from my cold, dead hands. And Joe Biden, who's stuck between this Clinton speech sandwich. I mean, he has to deal with Hillary last night, and then he's going to be overshadowed by Bill tonight. I mean, he just was turning paler and paler.
I like that Clinton speech sandwich. I'll have a Biden on Bill and Hill, please.
Exactly, yes.
What would you think of Michelle Obama's speech?
I thought Michelle Obama's speech was wonderful. I mean, it's a very tough role because, look, I mean, the president is both the head of state and the head of government. I mean, he's both a symbol and he's somebody who actually, executes policy. So he's able to talk about ideas and not just talk about himself as sort of a great American, a great father, brother, son, and all that. But the prospective first lady just has to play that role, that excruciating role. She's not allowed to talk about any policy ideas because she'll get in trouble. So this woman has to get up there. Everybody's waiting for the "I love America" line, and I'm sure she does love America, but it's a tough role. And the kids came out, and I thought it was irresistible.
And you've said in the past, I think, that first lady speeches tend to be ridiculous.
Yeah, I think they are ridiculous because they're dragged up onto stage. They probably don't want to be there. I feel badly for both these women, for Cindy McCain and Michelle Obama. So,
this is your fifth convention.
Yes.
You've been to both Republican and Democratic ones. Do you find a different basic attitude at each party's party?
There is something, and this is a really interesting idea, and it's mine. No one else has said it, and I'm really hoping it catches on and that people attribute it to me in lots of prestigious newspapers and on cable news shows, which really aren't prestigious, so I don't care about that. That the Democratic conventions actually tend to be more... I don't want to use the word tight-assed on radio, but it's whatever the smart way of saying that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Forgive me. Sorry about that. They tend to be more priggish, more sort of tightly wound, and the Republican ones tend to be more fun and looser, and there's also a lot more expensive hard liquor flowing. But I think part of it has to do with kind of playing against type. The Democrats want to make sure that they're seen as not as libertines, but as sort of strict and rules and a little bit serious. And the Republicans don't want to seem curmudgeonly because that's what they're pegged as. So a weird opposite thing happens. So here, I mean, I was for my Tonight Show spot, I was interviewing Mayor Hickenlooper, and I tried to bring in a giant piece of deep-fried broccoli. I won't explain why, but they said there's no food in the convention hall, and I said, you know, inside there, and I said, you know, look, this is just a prop for a bit. I won't eat it, and they said, no, absolutely no food, and it turned into a big fight. So anyway,
You know, the no food rule. I think it's just like when they hold the basketball games here. It's so that the vendors can sell us $6 hot dogs.
I wasn't actually going to eat the giant piece of deep-fried broccoli. It was obviously a prop.
They didn't get that.
Can I say one other thing that's very interesting? The Democrats are supposed to be, everybody says they're not supposed to pull a repeat of the Kerry thing. They're supposed to be attacking the Republican nominee. But it's hard to, this whole McCain disclaimer, every Democratic speech begins with, John McCain may be the greatest American hero ever, but his tax plan is lousy. And it's like everything is eclipsed by that disclaimer. You're not going to win, Democrats, if you keep doing that. You got to get rid of the McCain disclaimer.
Is it easier for you to be funny about Democrats or Republicans?
It's harder, much has been said about it, how hard it is to be funny about Barack Obama. It's a trickier thing. Although I do find this whole rock star idea kind of funny. It's sort of irresistible. So old age jokes, no.
And Mark Warner, you can't really be funny about Mark Warner.
It's hard to. And Mark, I guess he really lost his shot at the big time last night, didn't he?
Mo Rocca, where can people see you next? You doing the Tonight Show again
this
week?
I'm on the Tonight Show again tonight, and I have a really funny bit, and then my blog is morocca180.com.
Mo, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Talk to you later in the week. And now we bring you a bit more of our sounds from Denver. Here are protesters outside the convention center. This was recorded yesterday afternoon.
WNYC is supported by Prestige Lexus, offering the all-wheel drive RX hybrid with electric motor drive designed for higher fuel economy and lower emissions, located at 1000 Route 17, North Ramsey, New Jersey, and at prestigelexus.com. The River to River Festival, free music, art, and dance downtown. Upcoming performances include Ray Martinez, the Latin Giants of Jazz, and more. Details, rivertoriverNYC.com.
Wine isn't the only thing that gets better with age. Join us Thursday, September 25th for our first ever 40 and over singles event. Leonard Lopate hosts the evening, which features conversations with wine experts, wine tastings, and plenty of time to mingle. Raise a glass with other WNYC listeners Thursday, September 25th at the Housing Works Bookstore Cafe. Visit our website for details and tickets on the events page at WNYC.org.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now, Brandeis University history professor Peniel Joseph here at the Democratic Convention. Maybe you've been seeing him on PBS this week as a regular on their nighttime convention coverage. His specialties include the history of electoral politics and African-American history. He's the author of Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America, and he's working on a book to come out next year called From Black Power to Barack Obama. I guess before you finish that book, you have to see how this election turns out.
Absolutely.
He's gotten this far. Would it say a very different thing about the progression of equality in America or anything else if he wins or loses?
Certainly. I think it's been a historic campaign, and the fact that he's the first African-American nominee of a major party is a watershed historical moment, and that's going to happen tomorrow at Invesco. But I think if he wins in November, for the whole entire nation to witness that, really that symbolism, for the next 4 years would really be transformative at the local, national, and international level.
What has struck you most about this convention so far?
Well, I think it's the whole notion of e pluribus unum, you know, out of many, one. The whole notion that the Democratic Party, for the last, really since Jimmy Carter, has suffered from the being labeled as the party of special interest. And I think what all the speeches have tried to convey is that the Democratic Party is the party of universal interest. It's just that those universal interests are now in technicolor. So what's interesting about the convention, whether it's the speeches by Michelle Obama or Hillary Clinton or what have you, they've all tried to talk about diversity as a strength and really, again, being the party not of special interest but of universal interest. So even if you see African-Americans or Latinos or gays on stage, it's not that the party has a black agenda or a gay agenda or even a women's agenda. It's got an American agenda with this multiracial cast of characters.
But that's that line that Obama has to walk and that Obama and the delegates and the Democrats have to sell to, you know, to some degree skeptical white middle America. The line between being the first black nominee with all that means historically and as a good thing, and somehow a post-racial nominee, as he also tries to have it, about, you know, being an American, not being a black guy.
Certainly, and I think we've used that word post-racial, but we're tossing that around too much, because one of the things I argue in this forthcoming book is that Obama's candidacy has produced racial vertigo in America. And what I call racial vertigo, it really means upending our preconceived notions about the limitations and possibilities of being black and white or anything else in America. Meaning, by the time we look and see Obama as the nominee, it makes both black people and white people think beyond what is possible. It makes us all expand our imaginations. And for some older Americans, it makes people uncomfortable, quite frankly, because they didn't think this was possible. And I'm not saying just white Americans. I mean all Americans of a certain age who lived through the 60s did not think this moment could ever happen, at least in their lifetime.
Because it plays into all these anxieties that are out there right now, I think. Anxieties about change that people don't have control over. So on the one hand, those are economic, like the gas prices going up. On the other hand, they are racial. For a lot of white America, there was that report that was widely published from the census just this summer that said by, 2032 or something like that, there would be a majority non-white America. Mm-hmm. At the same time, seeing a black man as a Democratic Party nominee calling for change. I mean, there are subtexts that even if they're not intended, people are probably receiving.
Certainly. Race is an implicit context in this whole election cycle. We saw it in the Democratic primaries, especially in places like Ohio, especially in Pennsylvania, but really, most pointedly, Kentucky and West Virginia, there was some exit polls where 1 in 6 voters said race mattered, and 75% of those voters voted for Hillary Clinton. The candidate himself has really tried to talk about a race transcending democracy. The only time he talked about race was in March during the Reverend Wright controversy, and it was a very interesting speech because the speech was titled Toward a More Perfect Union, but he didn't talk about just black grievances. He also talked about white anxiety and white resentment. So there's a balance there.
And he talked about what blacks had to do among themselves to continue to improve their progress, which is, you know, usually the white mantra. You got to get your people together now. You know, stop committing crime and stop dropping out of school and stuff like that. And Barack Obama talks that stuff very comfortably.
Certainly. He talks about self-determination and individual responsibility and community-wide responsibility in a way that I think no other politician could in such a pointed fashion. So when he goes to a black church and talks about black fathers being missing, really, if a white politician did that, that would sound patronizing and condescending. If Obama does it, it really sounds more invigorating, at least to most African Americans.
By the way, on that stat about 75% of the voters saying that race mattered to their vote in those primaries voting for Clinton, those were white voters.
Those were white voters.
And I, when we talked about that a lot at the time, I got a lot of comments from white listeners who said, well, look, a lot of black voters are taking Barack Obama's race into account. It's not the only thing, but race matters to them. Why is that okay?
Well, when we think about it historically, blacks have only really had the right to vote in robust numbers since 1965. And when we think about presidential elections, they've never had an option of even voting for a black candidate unless you think about Jesse Jackson in the Democratic primaries in 1984 and 1988. So blacks have always voted for white candidates irrespective of race. Certainly there's a politics of pride here, just like Jack Kennedy was the first Irish Catholic president, and certainly Irish Americans were really prideful and proud that JFK was the nominee in 1960 and that they had their first Irish president. So I think that when African Americans take into account that, hey, this is a black candidate who really displays the best of us and the best of America. It's really much different from choosing a candidate based on a politics of supremacy or racial bias.
Peniel Joseph, my guest on WNYC, Brandeis University history professor, author of Waiting Till the Midnight Hour. Maybe you've seen him as one of the regulars doing analysis on PBS's convention coverage this week. I thought that this would be a good moment to play a little bit of Barack Obama's keynote speech from the 2004 convention, because that's, of course, what really launched him into the national consciousness. And everybody immediately said he's a potential future presidential nominee. I don't think most people thought it would be this quickly. But with all that's happened since, let's listen to less than a minute of Barack Obama circa 2004.
John Kerry believes in America. And he knows that it's not enough for just some of us to prosper. For alongside our famous individualism, there's another ingredient in the American saga. A belief that we're all connected as one people. If there is a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for their prescription drugs and having to choose between medicine and the rent, that makes my life poorer even if it's not my grandparent. If there's an Arab American family being rounded up without benefit of an attorney or due process, that threatens my civil liberties. It is that fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that makes this country work. E pluribus unum, out of many, one.
How different a speech do you think we're going to hear from Barack Obama this year?
Well, I think we're going to hear a lot of specifics. I think we're going to hear a lot of policy-oriented specifics that really target the working class, that really target the middle class. I think we're going to hear specifics about how the country can be moved forward in the next 4 years beyond the soaring rhetoric. Because I think the soaring rhetoric is important, and that has galvanized his campaign. And certainly the Obama campaign does have policy-specific proposals, but too often we haven't been able to, the American people have not been able to hear that. So I think what we're going to see Thursday is a very pragmatic speech that lifts people up, but at the same time tells people how we're going to get from A to B.
Now, your book is a narrative history of black power in America. And I want to play a clip of Bobby Seale, the Black Panther Party co-founder, in Chicago's Lincoln Park during the 1968 Democratic National Convention. This is a pretty famous clip, courtesy of Pacifica Radio Archives. Bobby Seale, 68. Outside the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Bobby Seale. And, you know, the some of the protests out here are going under the name Recreate 68, but it's hardly been that.
Certainly not. I mean, the fact that 40 years later, the Democratic Party has an African-American nominee after such a tumultuous convention in 68 really shows that we're living in a different historical time period.
The Bobby Seale clip, you smiled when that started to come on. You want to reflect on that historically?
Certainly. 1968 is an incredible year. In a lot of ways, it's the year of the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense is founded in Oakland, California in 1966 and really becomes the quintessential black power group. What's interesting about the Panthers, initially they are going to argue for a 10-point revolutionary program that includes ending police brutality, quality education, but also includes the right to bear arms. What's most fascinating about the Panthers, they talked about really guns and butter. They talked about defending the black community, even if that required violence, but also serving the people and starting free breakfast programs and survival programs.
Did that movement have to die for Barack Obama to be possible?
No, I think that movement evolved. What's interesting about Obama, I argue that Obama actually represents a synthesis of aspects of both the civil rights and black power movements. And what I mean by that is the civil rights movement talked about a transformative democracy. It talked about equal citizenship. It talked about radical egalitarianism. Black power talked about self-determination. It talked about pride. And it really tried to transform American democracy, but on its own terms. So Obama's run is really an audacious run. And remember, people as robust as Congressman John Lewis initially were Hillary Clinton supporters,
right,
who switched their superdelegate votes once they saw that the rising tide of history was making this black man be the potential nominee.
One more clip, just for the fun of it. We did Bobby Seale 68. Of course, we're here in 2008. How about former Texas Governor Ann Richards delivering the keynote address in 1988 when the opponent was George H.W. Bush?
We're not going to have the America that we want until we elect leaders who are going to tell the truth. Not most days, but every day. Leaders who don't forget what they don't want to remember. And for 8 straight years, George Bush hasn't displayed the slightest interest in anything we care about. And now that he's after a job that he can't get appointed to, he's like Columbus discovering America. He's found child care. He's found education. Poor George. He can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth.
I don't know we've heard anything quite that biting about John McCain here yet.
Certainly not yet. I think what this convention is waiting for is somebody who's going to really criticize McCain without the caveat of McCain as a war hero. I think they're treading a fine line with showing so much respect and deference.
Will it be Bill Clinton tonight when he talks about foreign policy?
Well, it's interesting. We heard Hillary Clinton's speech last night, and I thought it was a good speech. The Clintons still want to be power brokers within the Democratic Party, so it's going to be interesting to see whether he does.
20 seconds. Historic. Michael Beschloss on PBS with you last night wondered if Clinton did enough to praise Obama's ability, not just say that the issues and the party are important. 10 seconds. Did you agree with him?
Well, I think from a certain perspective, yes. Hillary did not do enough in terms of saying that he's ready and experienced enough to be a leader.
And we have to leave it there with Peniel Joseph, author of Waiting Till the Midnight Hour. His website is PenielEJoseph.com, PenielEJoseph.com. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer at the Democratic Convention on WNYC.